Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, a talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back, the Total Education Show on the Total Education Network. Remember, go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Well, I always get excited when it's time to welcome back my co-host to the program, Jared. How are you?
Very good today, Neil. How about you today?
Well, good. A few beverages before, so look out, Total Education Hour, and what could happen in the fireworks. At least will keep me awake with the crazy week that I've had. Miami Book Fair International, other more celebrities to interview. It continues. So let's go to our topic, and I thought, you know, we went through occupational therapy. Now let's think about physical therapy for birth to three. That's an interesting conversation as well, when you start to see a child that, based on some sort of disability, is just really not physically developing the way that they should, correct?
That's exactly right. I mean, those are things that when we recognize those, we sometimes need to bring in an early intervention, kind of a specialist that will focus really on those direct results that we'll be looking for.
And so how do you, I mean, like, what types of things should you be looking for, I guess, to identify if maybe your child need, because a lot of times you say, oh, yeah, kids walk late. But there's certain situations, these kids have already had certain disabilities that lead to having services for, like PT, correct?
Yes, that is right, Neil. And usually those are, again, determined during the evaluation. We have someone, an evaluating team that will really take a look at the fine motor skills, the large muscle skills, what we typically will call the gross motor development, and determine a kind of a plan of action of what might work best for the family.
Well, absolutely, Jared. And I think that creating that thing, so a lot of times it could be cerebral palsy, it could be so there could be other physical concerns, Jared, that are out there that lead you to that situation where they have those services. So I guess physically they just literally just have something when they were born with. So this the skills that the therapists teach at this time is very, very important, especially to get that child up to continue to progress, especially when physical ailments that they're dealing with won't hurt their normal everyday life, correct?
Absolutely. And again, these started some of the earliest stages. If, for instance, we know that a child is, even before they're born, are going to face some disabilities, some challenges, we can already have a team in place. After the child is born, we can do an evaluation, and premature children, this happens with particularly, even before they might be in the neonatal care unit, intensive care, and when that child leaves the hospital, there's a team in place that is ready to begin services. And physical therapy, but therapists are trained in a variety of ways to help families. So even sometimes a child may show a delay in motor development, and there isn't we wouldn't necessarily always have a physical therapist assigned right away. A developmental therapist who has a pretty extensive background in motor development can be brought in initially to get the family started.
Well, absolutely, Jared, and I think that that's important. So once they come in to the house, especially, what do they work on? What skills, especially let's say it's a two-year-old, we've touched upon birth to one, but what types of skills do you see them still far behind their peers?
Well, one of the first things we look at is walking. If a child is not walking by 15 months, and many children are walking well beyond that, but it's just well before that. But at 15 months, if a child is not walking, we can really kind of determine that there is a gross motor delay. But even before that, there's evidence of a gross motor delay, and we are working towards those ultimate goals. But at 2 years of age, you'd be looking for a child to run or walk, maintaining their balance in a variety of different movements. Kicking a ball is another skill that we would look for a child to have in place by 2 years of age. But again, if they're not in place, really we just recognize that as a delay, and we attempt to make attempt to create a plan to address those with the family.
So a lot of times, if you have PT, you're really lacking the learning how to walk correctly. Especially, it's so far behind the regular peers that there are different types of strategies you work with. I remember working with a little girl that was 2 and was having trouble walking. So we did a lot of things that would strengthen the leg muscles, and that's a key thing to go ahead and do, because a lot of times it's a harder process. Correct.
It is, yes. It really is. And so that would be an area that you would have in place. And you know, some things, a lot of times on our show, most of the time on our show, we always try to provide concrete examples. So we've been a little bit on the vague side. So let's take a look at some concrete examples. Your child is showing, let's go with 15 months. Your child is not yet walking. There are a variety of things that can be done within the daily routine that can build that core muscle area that needs to be strengthened for walking, and also provide opportunities to improve coordination, balance. Some of the things that you can do with a child that are very, very basic: stand them up propped against the sofa, their back instead of their chest. So many times we see parents and as adults, we see the child leaning with their chest against the sofa. Turn them around so that their back is resting against the sofa or the ottoman, or even a wall, or put the child in the corner of a wall where they'll have a lot of support. Have them reach out for toys. What you'll find is that child will begin to lean forward as they reach for the toy, and they may actually begin to start making some stepping movements. Of course, you're right there with your child, but there's an example of what we can do to promote strength and coordination that will eventually lead to walking.
Well, absolutely, and I think that's a great concrete example. I know there's others as well.
There is, and here's another one we use quite a bit. So now the child is standing. The child against the sofa, this time with their chest facing the sofa so they can lean against it. And what you can do at that point is let the child explore toys. Again, we're talking maybe 15, 16 months. Let the child explore toys from the sofa, and you lift one leg. So now that child is bearing weight all on one leg with a little bit of support from the, of course, from the leaning against the couch. But now the child is standing on one leg, putting lots of weight, and then you just change legs. You know? Count to 10, count to 20, put both legs down and lift the other one.
So when you're talking about bearing weight on one leg, what does that do?
Well, it helps them learn how to. First of all, it's putting all that child's weight onto one leg. So you're going to be giving them an opportunity to strengthen the muscles in one leg at a time. But it also teaches the child how they need to kind of shift their balance. And when they're walking, that child will, in effect, be standing on one foot when they start walking and running. So they will need to really kind of learn through muscle memory how to shift their weight and maintain their balance. So it's a good, it really is a good way to build skills by standing on one foot to build just a tremendous amount of skills for the child.
Well, definitely, Jarrett, and I think that's another great strategy, and I know our parents hopefully have a pen and paper and are jotting these down. What's another one?
Another one. Now let's go back a little bit sooner. You're recognizing we're at 12 months. Your child may not be crawling yet, or they. And by crawling, I mean up on their hands and knees, not necessarily an army crawl. We could get very technical on this show if we wanted to and use the absolutely precise terms, but sometimes that would be a little bit confusing. So when we say crawling, we mean up on their hands and knees and moving across the floor. You might see your child starting with an army crawl, but some things, again, that you can do with your child is get them into a hand and knee position, even if you have to support them, and then rock them back and forth gently, forward and backward. And so they almost look like they're a rocking horse. Like, this shifts weight from towards the front of the hand so that they're putting lots of weight on their hands, strengthening their wrists. And then when you rock them back, they're shifting weight to their hips and the torso that, again, provides coordination and strength building.
Very good, Jared. I like that whole strategy. You provide so many very good ones. Now, if your child does have physical issues, especially we're talking physical therapy issues, have you seen, even though kids have been born premature or have a certain disability, progress through these therapy techniques?
Absolutely. Again, we talk about it on this show all the time. Children reach milestones. Adults reach milestones at different times, and that's not a bad thing. And so, if your child is walking, I've seen this many times. The child, a very late walker, child not walking at 15 months. When you see that child a year and a half later, you would have never, many times, nobody would have ever guessed that they had physical therapy or developmental therapy and were late walkers.
Well, absolutely. And that's great news to hear, because a lot of times people think, oh, because of that disability, because my child's in early intervention, especially something like this, they're going to always be there. And that's not the case at all, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. And, it's offering hope, offering opportunities, presenting options so that child can participate.
Well, I just really have enjoyed our conversation, Jared. I think that what you're able to do to provide for early intervention is just fantastic. And always that's where book two will really provide the next level of things for. And to let you know, book one is almost rough draft one finished. I will be sending your copy of your tips to you very, very soon. We're on the path, I thought, November. But 2013 is going to be a really exciting year. My network's been picked up by some more stations for more days, which is fantastic. This show's name is going to change. So all those announcements will be coming close to 2013 because of all the new shows coming to the network. And I think it's great, and I think that you started this beginning process. We're very close to the anniversary of my first show I launched, the Total Education Hour. It'll be 3 years on December 6th. And it's great because I know for a fact that's what launched everything else. And we're doing something completely different than everyone else. And I think that's fantastic. So, Jared, thanks again for calling. And we'll be ready and keep going and keep persevering through this. But there are a lot of people behind us that really believe this is a great product. And we'll keep proving people wrong that there can't be education talk, because we know there can, because we always are helping families. So thanks again for calling.
All right. Thanks, Neil.
All right, Jared. Okay. All right. That was Jared. You're listening to Total Education Show on the Total Education Network. And we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Well, you know what? I am so excited. Every other week or twice a month, I get to interview authors from Inc. Think Tank. Remember to go to InkThinkTank.com to check out the great authors of Vicki Cobbs. I mean, they're just phenomenal nonfiction children's writers. I just enjoy talking to them all the time because it gets me that itch to be back in the classroom. Well, that itch will never stay because I'm an entrepreneur and love my tutoring and consulting company, but I always like to tell my other teachers about this. So I want to welcome to the program Penny Coleman, author of Thanksgiving, the true story. Penny, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. It's good to talk with you, Neil.
Fantastic. I'm excited to talk to you as well, because I think that this is a great time to talk, especially
yes.
when it comes up that we're very close to Thanksgiving, and our listeners will probably listen to it after Thanksgiving. But I guess Thanksgiving is a November holiday in so many ways that we have to understand why we're so thankful for things. So I think that's a key part of the beginning I wanted to bring up even before we talk about the book, is how important it is to be thankful.
Yes, and if we follow in the tradition of Native Americans, whom I write about in my book, the Wampanoag, who were in Massachusetts, we'll be thankful every day. We'll be thankful when we wake up. We'll be thankful throughout the day. So I think I look at Thanksgiving as just an acceleration of something that I certainly try to practice myself. I happen to live in the area that was badly hit by Hurricane Sandy. So all of us in this northeastern region, the New York, Connecticut, New Jersey region, have many people on our minds, the people who are still without power and the people who, you know, the youngsters who still aren't back in their schoolroom. So thankfulness is something that I think we always should have in our hearts and in our minds.
You're so right, Penny. And I just wanted to bring that up just because it's such an important thing. But now the book, I think that this book is different than a lot of Thanksgiving books. Why is it?
Well, I think because I set out to find the answer to some questions that were very much on my mind. And actually, the questions originated from an experience I had when I was a professor at Queens College, and I was teaching teachers who were getting their master's degree. It was the day before Thanksgiving. We were having a conversation about food, and one of the teachers, I think she was a third-grade teacher, said, sort of in a low voice, we have turkey, but on the side, nobody eats it. And her phrase just caught my ear, and I turned and I looked at her, and I said, what? And she said, we have it on the side, and nobody eats it. And I said, well, what do you eat? And it turns out that her heritage was Italian. And what they have for Thanksgiving is a whole spread of the traditional Italian menu of, you know, lasagna and, you know, the sausage and on and on and on. And then another student who was of Greek ancestry piped up and she said, oh, my mother's been cooking for 3 days, spanakopita, moussaka. And then a Korean student said, oh, we always have kimchi. Well, my experience growing up with a father who was a staunch New Englander, his roots were, you know, back to the Mayflower, and a mother who had immigrated from Eastern Europe, who wanted to be as an American as my father, I grew up where it was just the traditional, you know, the 1621 Pilgrim and Indian story and all the traditional foods, you know, cranberry, turkey, mashed potatoes, gravy. And so this was an astonishing moment for me. And because I'm inherently a very curious person, I thought, wow, I need to know more about this. And so that also led me to ask another question. Well, what is the true story? What are the antecedents of the Thanksgiving we celebrate today? And then the next question that came to me was, well, when did this 1621 Pilgrim and Indian story become the dominant narrative of the culture? So my book is really a combination. So when I set out to write my book, I decided to write it in a way that readers could actually not only engage with the questions that I asked and the answers that I found, but that I would also write about my process, about the survey I sent out, about the primary and secondary sources that I looked at, about my picture research. So it's a combination of content and process that are intertwined throughout. So it was really fun to write, and I think it's a really engaging read and particularly useful in classrooms in this day of Common Core, because you know, I reveal so much of what writers do when they set out to write engaging nonfiction books.
Well, exactly. I think that you have to engage your audience and to understand this, and it's a really good question. What is the true story of Thanksgiving? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say basically that the fact is that that people think of that one story you talk about, but that's not the case, is it, Penny?
No, and I actually discovered, again, to my astonishment, that I actually included a chart in my book, a 2-page chart, and also a map, because I discovered there are, in fact, 12 competing claims for the first Thanksgiving. And in the chart, I document the date and the claim and the evidence that's used to substantiate the claim. And they date back to the 1500s. There are two in Texas and two in Florida and a couple in Virginia and five in Massachusetts, one in Maine. And all of these claims are based on historical documents, and several of them are actually celebrated today. Celebrated in the year 2012. There's a reenactment of an event from the 1500s that it takes place in Texas, and then the Berkeley Plantation, which is a historic site in Virginia, claims to be the first Thanksgiving in 1619, and they actually have a shrine to the first Thanksgiving and have reenactments. So that was, first of all, the astonishing thing I discovered. So that led me to then say, well, what are the origins? And so based on my research, and I'm talking about the origins for the antecedents of the Thanksgiving we celebrate today, and based on my historical research, I concluded that there are three. Two very, very, very ancient traditions and a determined woman. And the two traditions are the ancient tradition of celebrating the harvest, which has always been part of the Native American populations in this country, and also what came with the early colonists. In England, for generations, centuries, they had celebrated the harvest festival, you know, the Dutch. I mean, all of the people, the early settlers, had this tradition of harvest festivals that they brought. The second tradition is also ancient, of civic and religious authorities establishing special days to give Thanksgiving. For example, a day of Thanksgiving to celebrate a military victory, or a day of Thanksgiving to celebrate the end of a drought or an epidemic. And again, there are many references throughout history in all times and all places of these kinds of days being set aside. The third antecedent is a woman named Sarah Josepha Hale, who was arguably one of the most, if not the most, influential magazine editors of the 1800s. She was editor of Godet's Ladies' Magazine, which had enormous circulation, over 150,000 people at one time. And she had grown up in New England. And this tradition of having this fall celebration that we've come to call Thanksgiving really emerged in the late 1600s in the Connecticut River Valley and then spread throughout New England. So she had grown up with this tradition, and she became determined to have it spread throughout the country and be declared a national day of Thanksgiving. So using her pen and her influence as a powerful editor, she started a 40-year campaign. And she would write letters to governors and military authorities and five different presidents every year and exhort them to declare this national holiday. She would keep a record in her magazine of how it had spread. In 1857, she reports that Thanksgiving celebrations happened in St. Petersburg, Russia, and Rome, and London, and on board a ship off the coast of Japan. And she's exhorting on over and over and over, because she believes fervently that this would be a way to bring together what she calls the mixed population of this country, and would cause people to embrace peace and family.
Quite interesting, and I guarantee we couldn't talk about all 12 because it would just take too much time. People have to buy the book. So is there another one of the claims that you really like that's one of your favorites?
Well, I think I think that my favorite is to really embrace what I discovered to be the true story. Is the one that I've embraced when I talk about Thanksgiving and when I go into schools and talk with teachers, is to talk about these two ancient traditions and Sarah Josepha Hale's role, and also to talk about when did the traditional narrative of the 1621 come into the popular culture. When did that become the story that emerged? And again, based on my research, it first begins to appear in history textbooks, in books for kids, in schools in the late 1890s and early 1900s. That's the first documented reference that I found, and I read many old, textbooks from history textbooks from that time and children's books. I read many magazines and, newspapers looking for reference. Sarah Josepha Hale herself never mentions in 40 years. She actually connects the holiday to an event in Boston in 1630 when a ship arrived with supplies for residents of Boston who were suffering from a famine, and to the Jewish holiday of Sukkot, the harvest festival. So when I talk about it, those are sort of my favorite things to talk about, being somebody who thinks that a narrative that is rooted in historical evidence and also a narrative that's more encompassing is much more exciting and interesting for particularly kids in school than just this, well, there was this one event. Because
right.
The story is more interesting, and it's also the truth. It's also can be documented.
Well, absolutely. And you look at how things came about, you never would have thought that it didn't go in the history books until 1800.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't have. You just taught me something right there. And I guess the other part, that the Native Americans were really the ones involved in this, and the stories of the pilgrims were kind of just brought in to make it interesting and to look at that. So that's a surprise. I think that surprises a lot of kids when you go in to visit them, don't you?
Well, also one of the other things that I think is useful to think about is sort of what was going on in American history at the time that this event that has become iconic, this 1621 event of the Native Americans welcoming these strangers and saving them from starvation. And so at this point, because this emerges, as I said, in the late 1890s, where the first textbook I found was dated 1895, a history textbook that was widely used in schools. Is the first one, and what I was using was the collection of old textbooks that's in the rare book collection at Teachers College at Columbia, and I think the interesting thing to think about is that 1890 in American history is what historians have talked about as the end of the frontier. It's also the end of the Indian Wars. The wars that have been being fought since the 1600s, started in New England against the Pequot in the 1600s and then spread to the West after the Civil War. But that's over in 1890, and the surviving Indians are on reservations. So that this threat that had encompassed many parts, in terms of the spread of the settlers to this country, is over. And so this story can emerge, and there actually I found a 1901 New York Times article writing about how Indians on a reservation are celebrating Thanksgiving. So this story, in a sense, I mean, last night I gave a program to a group of adults, and one of the women, after I was talking about this, one of the women said to me, she said, so this story, this 1621 event, is in a sense a whitewash. It's sort of a narrative that covers over or obliterates the 250-year story of the Indian Wars, the annihilation of the Native American population. And it's interesting because it was a story that also very much appealed to immigrants like my mother.